Chapter 10. Down. Dr. Bershilde of Ravello. Kanyar the Sharp. It was the fourth speeder that had been hunting us. Before I could even let out a curse, its streaming cannon fire had severed our tail boom and mangled the aft fan, shredding off its cover and twisting the still-spinning props. We started to rotate violently. The cabin vibrated like a seizure victim. Elena screamed. I wrestled with the controls, fighting the bucking stick. I cranked the wing fans to vertical and throttled up to break the drop. The flyer crunched down through upper branches, glanced off a main bow, and nosedived. I stood on the rudder and yanked back the stick. "Brace!" I yelled. That was all I had time to say. We sideswiped a Fainwood's trunk, a collision that ripped off the port fan and stripped the monocoque's hull paint down to the bare metal, and bounced once off a peaty ridge of moss and leaf mould. Then we rose again, yawing to the left as the remaining turbofan screamed to the edge of its tolerance, trying to gain some sort of lift. The engine out alarm shrilled as the fan stalled, overcome by the pressure. We fell then, sideways, survived a headlong impact with an oak that crazed the windshield and slammed into the loamy earth, slithering a good 50 meters before we rocked to a halt on our side. I didn't black out, but the long silence following the crash made it feel like I had. I blinked, lying on my shoulder against the side hatch. Elena moaned and Amos started coughing. The only other sound was the tinkling patter of the shattered windscreen scads gradually collapsing into the cabin. I got up and clambered over the seats. "Elena, are you hurt?"
"No, sir. I don't think so."
"We have to get out. Help me." Together we dragged the coughing Amos clear and went back for Medea, who was still, mercifully, unconscious. The searchlights of the speeder lanced down through the hole we had made in the canopy, poking around. Any moment now. Elena and I dragged the other two into the shelter of a hollow, a good distance from the downed aircraft. "Stay here," I whispered to her. "Give me your weapon." Silently, she offered me her stubby las pistol. "Stay down," I advised, and ran back to the wreck, retrieving my staff and my sword. I tossed the rune staff into the undergrowth to keep it out of sight, and drew Barbaris Sater. The speeder was coming down through the upper branches, trying to pick out the flyer with its stab light. I tucked the sword and pistol into my belt and lunged up into the lower branches of the gross beech that overlooked our crash site. The tree was huge and gnarled. Grunting, I swung myself up into the main boughs and then further up into the web of thinner branches. The speeder hovered into view, crawling slowly towards the smoking wreck, its searchlight playing back and forth. I could see the masked side gunner in the open door, one hand on the yoke of the pintle-mounted autocannon, the other on the bracket of the lamp. The speeder descended. I climbed higher, up into the lofty reaches of the beach, until I could climb no further and the hovering speeder was directly below me. The pilot said something. I distinctly heard the crackle of his intervox. The door gunner replied and let go of the lamp, setting both hands on the cannon's grips, turning it to aim down at the crumpled flyer. The glade below me filled with flashes and booms as he riddled the airplane with his cannon fire. The valiant little Urdeshi craft shredded like tinfoil. The door gunner stopped shooting and called down to his pilot. Now or never. I let go of the branches and dropped straight onto the roof of the speeder. It rocked slightly beneath me. I steadied myself, crouched down, gripped the upper frame of the door hatch and swung in, boots first. The gunner was bent over with his back to the hatch, getting a fresh ammunition box from the wall rack. My boots connected with his lower back and shunted him face first against the cabin wall. I landed beside him as he staggered backwards, his hands clutching at his broken face, grabbed him by the arm and propelled him backwards out of the hatch. We were 10 meters up. The pilot gave a muffled grunt as he looked round and saw me. A second later, the muzzle of the las pistol was pressed against the corner of his jaw. "Set down. Now," I said. I prayed I was dealing with a mercenary and not a cultist. A merc would know when to cut his losses and bargain to live for another day and another paycheck. A cultist would fly us into the nearest tree, gun or no gun. Making his motions very slow and clear so I could be sure to read them, the pilot cut the speeder's main thruster and sank us to the forest floor. "Shut us down," I said. He obeyed, and the lift units hummed to a halt. The dashboard went blank apart from a few orange standby lights. "Unstrap. Get out." He unbuckled his harness and slowly pulled himself up out of the pilot's seat as I covered him with the pistol. He was a short but well-built man in ablative armour and a grey flight helmet with a breathing visor. He jumped down from the speeder's side hatch and stood with his hands raised. I got down next to him. "Take off the helmet and toss it back into the speeder." The pilot did as he was told. His skin was pale and freckled, his thinning hair shaved close. He regarded me with edgy blue eyes. "Unzip the suit," he frowned. "To the waist." Keeping one hand raised, he drew the zipper of the Ablat suit down, revealing an undervest and shoulders marked with old, blurry tattoos. The psi shield was a small, disc-shaped device hung round his neck on a plastic cord. I snapped it off and tossed it into the undergrowth. Then I used my will.
"Name,"
he growled, grimacing.
"Name." "I know Goran."
I nudged my mind against his. It was like rubbing up against something sheathed in plastic. "Right, we both know that's an inflated identity." A rush job from the feel of it.
"Real name?"
He shook his head, his teeth clenched. M-plate IDs were cheap enough to buy on the black market, especially a fairly poor quality one like this. They were fake personalities, usually sold with matching papers, psi woven over the subject's persona like a fitted dust cover on a piece of furniture. Nothing fancy. If you had the money, you could buy fingerprints and retinas to match. If you really had the money, a new face too. This one was like a false wall erected in a hurry to ward off casual minds. It lacked any sort of real history, not even vague biographical engrams. A mind mask as cheap and unrealistic as the carnival faces his comrades had worn. But, though poor, it had been put in place with great force. I tried to shift it, but it wouldn't budge. That was frustrating. It was obviously false, but I couldn't get past it. There was no time to worry at it now.
"Out,"
I willed, and he collapsed unconscious.
"Elena, Amos, come on,"
I shouted, dragging the limp man back into the speeder. I checked him for weapons. There were none, and then lashed his hands behind his back with a length of cable from the speeder's pulley spool. By the time Elena and Amos reached me, carefully bearing Medea, I had the pilot gagged and blindfolded and tied to one of the speeder's internal crossmembers. We got everything aboard, the items we had rescued from my study, the rune staff, all of it, and secured Medea in a pull-down cot in the aft of the speeder's crew bay. Then I got into the pilot's seat and, once I'd made sense of the control layout, got us airborne. I edged up just above the treetops, running unlit. The moon was up and the night was clear, apart from a brown smudge against the stars away to the north. The smoke from my burning estate, I had no doubt. There was no sign of anything else in the air. Hugging the tips of the trees, I turned us south. Once we were underway, I checked out the cockpit. It was clearly an ex-military flyer, bought for the purpose, in my opinion. Insignia mouldings had been chiselled off, service numbers erased with acid swabs. Apart from the basic controls, the cabin was provided with several socket racks where optional instrument modules could be bolted in. Only a Vox set had been fitted. There were gaps where an Auspex, a terrain reader, and night vision displays might have gone, and also slots for a navigation codifier and a remote fire control system that would have slaved the door weapon to a pilot and done away with the necessity of a separate gunner. Whoever had supplied the mercenaries with their vehicles had provided only the most basic package. An armed troop lifter with an old model Voxcaster comm. No automated systems. No clue to origin or source. But it had decent power and range, over 1,000 kilometers left in it before it would need a recharge. Something to get them in, lay down cover, and get them out again. The forest flickered by beneath us. The Vox burbled intermittently, but I had no idea of the codes or cant they were using, and little desire to let anyone know the flyer was still operational. After a while, it shut off. I unplugged it, pulled it out of its rack, and told Elena to toss it overboard.
"Why?"
she asked.
"I don't want to risk it having a tracker or transponder built into it,"
she nodded. I tried to get our bearings manually, using the basic instrumentation, working to reconstruct a map of the area in my head. It was pretty much guesswork. Dorsey, the nearest main city, was perhaps an hour west of us now, but given the scale of the operation mounted against me, I felt going there would be like flying into a carnadon's den. There were small fishing communities and harbour towns on the east side of the Inshume headland, the closest now more than 2 hours away. Madua, a chapel town in the southeast, was in range. So was Entrive, a market city on the fringe of the wild woodland. So were the Atenate Mountains. I thought about calling the Arbites on the Vox, but decided against it. The attack on Spaten House must surely have been noted by sentries at Dorsay, especially once the main fires started, but no emergency support units had come. Had the Arbites been paid to turn a blind eye? Had they been more complicit still in the raid? Until I understood who and what my enemies were, I could trust no one, and that included the authorities and even the Inquisition itself. Not for the first time in my life, I was effectively alone. I headed for the mountains, for Ravello. Ravello is a hill town in the flanks of the western Atenates, situated at the foot of the Insa Pass, on the shores of a long freshwater lake that forms the headwaters of the Great Drunna. It has a small but distinguished universitariate, specializing in medicine and philology, a brewery that exports its lake water ale all over Gudrun, and a fine chapel dedicated to St. Calwyn, which houses, to my mind, some of the best religious frescoes in the subsector. It is a quiet place, steep and densely packed, its old buildings lining narrow hill streets so tightly their green copper roofs overlap like plate armour. From the air, it looked like a patch of dark moss clinging to the blue slopes of the Itaval. The sun was rising as we approached from the north. The air was clear, a baking blue. We had left the wild woodland in the first touches of dawn and climbed up into the foothills, following the line of the Atenate miners up into the higher altitudes. The Itaval was high enough to have cloud cover around its peak, but across the lake, the first of the great giants rose, Esembo, ragged like a tooth. Mons Fulco, a violet triangle stabbing the sky, snow-capped Corvaccio, the sport and bane of recreational climbers. We were nearly out of power and the speeder was getting sluggish. I dropped us to road level and came in through the western gate. There were no traffic and no pedestrians. It was still early in the morning. The streets were paved with the same blue-grey ooslite that the buildings were constructed from, bright in the sunlight, dank in the shadows of the narrow streets. We passed through a square where a student lay, sleeping off a night's drinking on the lip of a small fountain, along a wider avenue where ground cars and civilian flyers were parked in a herringbone, and then turned up a narrow street and climbed the hill out of the glare of the sun. I opened the speeder's windows and breathed in the fresh, clear air. The muted sounds of the flyers' engines washed back at me, reflected oddly by the tall, shuttered faces of the dwellings on either side of the steep, paved lane. It had been a long time, but I still knew my way around. We parked in a cul-de-sac alley just off the lane, little more than a blunt courtyard where a mountain spurra struggled to grow against the face of a wall. The spurra, or at least its little yellow spring flowers, were the emblem of St. Culwin, and votive bottles and coins littered the little stone basin the tree was growing from. A first-floor shutter twitched at the sound of our engines, and I was glad I had asked Amos to stow the door gun during our flight. At least we resembled a private transport. "Stay here," I told Alina and Amos. "Stay here and wait." I walked back down the street in the quiet morning. I was still wearing the boots, breeches, shirt and leather coat I had put on before the auto seance the night before, but Amos had lent me his drab green cloak. I made sure I was displaying no insignia or badge of office, except my signet ring, which would pass notice. Medea's auto-pistol, reloaded with shells from a box magazine we found on the speeder, was tucked into the back of my belt. A stray dog, coming up from the town centre towards me, paused to sniff my cloak hem and then trotted on its way, uninterested. The house was as I remembered it, halfway down the lane. We had passed it on the way up, and now I made certain. Four stories, with a terrace balcony at the top under the eaves of the copper-tiled roof. The windows were shuttered, and the main entrance, a pair of heavy panelled wooden doors painted glossy red, were bolted shut. There was no bell, I remembered that. I knocked once and waited. I waited a long time. Finally, I heard a thump behind the doors, and an eye slit opened.
"What is your business so early?"
asked an old man's voice. "I want to see Dr. Bershilde."
"Who is calling?"
"Please let me in, and I will discuss it with the doctor."
"It is early,"
the voice protested. I raised my hand and held my signet ring out so its design was visible through the eye slit. "Please," I repeated. The slit shut,
There was a rattle of keys, and then one of the doors opened into the street. Inside was just shadow. I stepped into the delicious cool of the hall, my eyes growing accustomed to the gloom. A hunched old man in black closed the door behind me.
"Right here, sir,"
he said, and shuffled away. The floor was polished marble mosaic that sparkled where scraps of exterior light caught it. The wall patterns had been hand-painted by craftsmen. Exquisite antiquarian anatomical sketches lined the walls in simple gilt frames. The house smelled of warm stone, the cold aftersense of a fine evening meal. Smoke.
"Hello?"
A voice filtered down from the stairs above me. I went up a flight, onto a landing where shutters had been opened to let the daylight stream in. "I'm sorry to intrude," I said.
"Gregor. Gregor Eisenhorn."
Dr. Bershildi of Ravello took a step towards me, registering sleepy astonishment. She was still a very fine figure of a woman. I think she was about to hug me, or plant a kiss on my cheek, but she halted and her face darkened.
"This isn't social, is it?" she said.
I went back to the speeder and flew it round to the private walled courtyard behind her residence, where it was screened from view. The doctor's old manservant, Fabes, had opened the ground floor sun doors and stood ready with a gurney for Medea. Elena, Amos, and I followed them inside. I left the pilot, still in his will-induced fugue state, tied up in the flyer. Crezier Bershildi had put on a surgical apron by then and met us in the ground floor hall. She said little as she examined Medea and checked her vitals.
"Take her through," she told her man, then looked at me. "Anybody else injured?"
"No," I said. "How is Medea?"
"Dying," she said.
All humour had gone from her voice. She was angry, and I didn't blame her.
"I'll do what I can."
"I'm grateful, Crezier. I'm sorry I've troubled you with this."
"She ought to go to the town infirmary," she snapped.
"Can we avoid that?
Can we make this unofficial, you mean?" "Damn you, Eisenhorn, I don't need this."
"I know you don't." She pursed her lips.
"I'll do what I can," she repeated. "Go through into the drawing room. I'll have Fabes bring some refreshment."
She turned on her heel and disappeared into the house after Medea.
"So,"
said Amos quietly,
"who is this again?"
Dr. Crezier Bershildi was one of the finest anatomists on the planet. Her treatises and monographs were widely published throughout the Helican subsector. After years of practice in Dorset and, for a period, off-world on Messina, she had taken up the post of Professor of Anatomy here at Ravello. And, a long time ago, I had nearly married her. 145 years earlier, in 241 to be exact, I had lost my left hand during a firefight on Samiter. The details of the case are unimportant, and besides, they are recorded elsewhere. I was fitted with a prosthetic, but I hated it and never used it. After 2 years, during a stay on Messina, I had surgeons equip me with a fully functioning graft. Crezier had been the chief surgeon during that procedure. Becoming involved with a woman who has just sewn a vat-grown clone hand onto your wrist is hardly a way to meet a wife, I realize. But she was quick-witted, learned, vivacious, and not put off by my calling. For years we were involved, on and off, first on Messina, then at a distance, and then on Gudrun, once she had moved back to Ravello to take up her doctorate, and I had based myself at Spaten House. I had been very fond of her. I still was. It is difficult to know if I should use a word stronger than fond. We never did to each other, but there are times I would have done. I had not seen her for the best part of 25 years. That had been my doing. We sat in the drawing room for over an hour. Fabes had opened the windows and the day's brilliance blasted in, turning the tulle window nets into hanging oblongs of radiant white. I could smell the clean, fresh chill of mountains. The drawing room was furnished with fine old pieces of furniture and filled with rare books, surgical curios, and display cases full of immaculately restored antique medical apparatus. Amos was quickly lost in close study of the items on display, murmuring to himself. Elena sat quietly on a tub chair and composed herself. I was fairly sure she was inwardly reciting the mind-soothing exercises of the distaff. Every few minutes she would absently brush a few strands of brown hair off her slender face. The doctor's man returned with a silver serving cart. Yeast bread, fruit, oily butter, and piping hot black caffeine.
Do you need anything stronger?
He asked. No, thank you. He pointed to a weighted silk rope by the door.
Ring if there's anything you need.
I poured caffeine for us all, and Amos helped himself to a hunk of bread and a ripe ploin. Ilina tonged half a dozen lumps of amber sugar crystal into her little cup.
Who did it?
She asked at length. Ilina?
Who raided us, sir?
The simple answer. I have no idea. I'm working on possibilities. It may take us a while to find out, and first we have to be secure.
Are we safe here?
Yes, for the time being.
They were mercenaries, said Amos, dabbing crumbs from his wrinkled lips. That is beyond question.
I thought as much.
The pilot you captured. You saw the tattoos on his torso.
I did, but I couldn't read them. Amos sipped his hot, sweet drink.
Bes Futu, the language of the Vessarine Janissaries.
Really? Are you sure?
Reasonably so, he said. The man has a repatriation bond written on his skin.
I considered this news. Vessa was a feral world on the rimward borders of the Antimar subsector that bred a small but hardy population, famous for its vicious fighters. Attempts had been made to form a guard regiment there, but the Vessarine were hard to control. It wasn't that they lacked discipline, but they found loyalty to Terra too cerebral a concept. They were bonded into clan families, understanding simply the material wealth of land, property, homestead, and weapons. As mercenaries, therefore, they excelled. They would fight, peerlessly, savagely, and to the death, in the Emperor's name, provided that name was stamped on high-denomination coinage. No wonder the attack on Spaten House had been so direct and efficient. In hindsight, it was remarkable any of us had got out alive. I was glad I hadn't known who they were at the time. If I had been told I was facing Vessarine Janissaries, I might have frozen up, instead of charging them head-on to rescue Medea. I took off the cloak Amos had lent me, and also my leather coat, and rolled up the sleeves of my shirt. The sun was warming the drawing-room. I had just taken the pistol out of my belt to check it, when Crezia came into the room. She was peeling off surgical gloves, and when she saw the gun in my hands, her already sour look became fiercer. She pointed sharply at me and then gestured outside.
Now, she said, curtly.
I pushed the weapon into the folds of the cloak on the table and followed her out, across the hall and into a sitting room hung with oil paintings and hololithic prints. The shutters in here were still shut, and she made no attempt to open them. She turned up the lamp instead.
Shut the door,
she instructed. I pushed the door shut. Crezia, I began. She held up a strong, warning finger.
Don't start, Eisenhorn. Just don't. I'm this damn close to throwing you out. How dare you...
Medea, I interrupted firmly. How is she?
Stable. Just about. She was shot in the back with a laser weapon, and the wound was left untreated for several hours. How do you think she is?
She'll survive?
Unless there are complications. She's on life support in the basement suite.
Thank you, Crezia. I'm in your debt.
Yes, you damn well are. You're unbelievable, Eisenhorn. 25 years. 25 years I don't see you. I don't hear from you, and then you turn up unannounced, uninvited, armed, and on the run. So it would appear, with one of your party shot. And you expect me just to take this in my stride?
Not really. I know it's a terrible imposition. But the Crezia Bershildi I knew could cope with an emergency now and then. And she always had time for a friend in need.
A friend?
Yes. You're the only person I can turn to, Crezia. She snorted scornfully and tugged off her apron.
All those years I was happy to be the one you could turn to, Gregor. And you never did. You kept me at arm's length. You never wanted me involved in your business. And now?
She let the words trail off and shrugged unhappily. I'm sorry.
You bring guns into my house. She hissed.
I probably shouldn't tell you about the mercenary tied up in my speeder, then, I said. She snapped round to look at me, incredulous, and then shook her head with a grim smile.
Unbelievable. 25 years and you roll up at dawn, bringing trouble with you.
No. No one knows I'm here. That's one of the reasons I came.
Are you sure?
I nodded. Someone raided my residence last night. Razed it. Murdered my staff.
I don't want to hear this.
We barely got out alive. I needed sanctuary and medical help for Medea.
I needed to find somewhere I knew would be safe.
I don't want to hear any more, she snarled. I don't want to be tangled up in your battles. I don't want to be involved. I have a nice life here, and
you do need to hear it. You need to know what's going on.
Why? I'm not going to get involved. Why the hell didn't you go to the Arbites?
I can't trust anyone, not even the authorities right now.
Damnation, Eisenhorn! Why me? Why here?
Because I trust you. Because my enemies may have every known associate of mine on the planet under observation, every Arbites precinct, every office of the Ministerium and the Imperial Administratum. But our relationship is secret. Even my closest friends don't know we were ever associated.
Associated? Associated? You know how to flatter, you pig.
Please, Crezia. There are a few things I need to do. A few things I need to arrange. A little help I need to ask of you. Then we'll be gone, and you'll never have to worry about this again. She sat down on a chaise and rubbed her hands together anxiously.
What do you need?
To begin with, your forbearance. After that, access to a private vox link. I'll need you to summon an astropath, if that's in any way possible, and also have your man purchase clothes and other items for us. The town tailors will be closed today. I can wait. There may be clothes here. Very well. There's a vox link in my study. I went to look in on Medea, who was sleeping peacefully in the scrubbed medical suite built into the basement of Crezia's townhouse, and then retired to the room Phaebes had prepared for me. Elena and Amos were in adjoining rooms, resting. I bathed and shaved, doing both activities on automatic as my mind worked things through. I discovered my body had acquired several new bruises since the day before, and a lasgraze across the thigh I hadn't even noticed. My clothes were dirty, torn and smoke-damaged, and the breeches were covered in burrs and sticky grass seeds. Phaebes had laid some clothes out in my room, several changes of male attire. I recognized they were my own. I'd kept clothes here over the years, mostly soft, informal wear, to change into when I visited. Crezia had stored them. I didn't know whether to be delighted or alarmed. All these years, and she hadn't thrown out the possessions I'd left in her territory. They were fresh, too, as if aired or laundered regularly. I realized that Crezia Bershildi had always expected me to return one day. Perhaps it was the manner of my return that had upset her, that I came back for her help and not simply for her. I couldn't blame her for that. I wouldn't be pleased to see me now, considering the trouble I was in. And not if I had broken all links of friendship 2.5 decades before. The chapel bells were ringing in the town below, calling the faithful for worship. Lakeside inns were opening up, and the smells of roasting and herbs were carried on the breeze. I chose a dark blue cotton shirt with a thin collar, a pair of black twill trousers, and a short flat-fronted summer jacket of black suede. The boots I had been wearing the night before would have to make do, but I scrubbed them clean with a cloth. I wanted to tuck the pistol into my jacket, but I knew how Crezia felt about guns, so I left it, with Barbariseta and the runestaff, under the mattress of my bed. The sacks of scrolls and manuscripts Amos and I had rescued from Spaten were with him in his room. I had little else with me. My signet ring, a short-range hand vox, some coins, and my warrant of office. A metal seal in a leather wallet. It was the first time since Jura that I missed my rosette. Fischig still had that, wherever he was. As I hung my leather coat up in the wardrobe, I felt a weight in it, and remembered I did have something else. The Malus Codicium. It was an infernal book, thrice damned. I knew of no other copy in existence. One half of the Inquisition would kill me to get their hands on it, and the other half would burn me for having it in my possession. Quixos, the corrupt veteran Inquisitor I had finally brought to account on Farnus Beta, had built his power upon it. I should have destroyed it when I destroyed him, or at least surrendered it to the Ordo. I had done neither. Using it, secretly studying it, I had increased my abilities. I had captured and bound Cherubael using its lore. I had broken open several cult conspiracies, thanks to the insight it had given me. It was only a small thing, fat, soft-covered in simple black hide, the edges of its pages rough and hand-cut. Innocuous. I sat down in the corner of the bed and weighed it in my hands. Splendid mid-morning sunlight shone in through the casement. The sky was blue. The slopes of the Itaval, visible from the rear of the house, a soft lilac. But I felt cold and plunged into darkness. I'd never really thought about why I had saved that hideous work for my own ends. Knowledge, I suppose. Curiosity. I had encountered prohibited artifacts many times in my life, the most notorious being the accursed Necrotuke. That loathsome thing had possessed a life of its own. It stung to the touch. It lured you in and coerced you into opening it. Just to be near it was to poison the mind. But the Codicium was silent. It always had been. It had never seemed alive, like the other toxic, rustling volumes I have encountered. It had always been just a book. The contents were disturbing, but the book itself. I wondered now. The moment it had come into my possession, things had started to change. Starting with Cherubale and on to the bleak events on Jura. Maybe it was poisoning me. Maybe it was twisting my mind. Maybe I had crossed far too far over the line without realizing it, thanks to its baleful influence. Perhaps that was a measure of how evil it was, that it was painless, invisible, insidious. The moment you touched the Necrotuke, you knew it was a vile thing. You knew you had to resist its seductive corruption. You knew you were fighting it. But the Malus Codicium, so infinitely evil, so subtle, seeping slowly into a man's soul before he even knew it. Was that how a servant of the Emperor as great as Quixos had become a monster? I had always wondered why he had never seen what he was becoming, why he was so blind to his own degeneration. I opened the drawer of my nightstand and put the book inside. As soon as we were clear of Ravello, I would have to deal with it. I went down to Crezia's study and found the Voxlink. There was a hololithic Pict unit, too, and I tuned that in. Morning broadcasts, weather, planetary news. I watched for some time, but there was no mention of any incident in the Dorsay region. I had anticipated as much, but it was still unnerving. I used the Vox and listened in to the Imperial channels, eavesdropping on Arbites frequencies, PDF transmissions, Ministorum links. Nothing. Either no one knew what had happened the night before at Spaten House, or they were staying ominously silent. I needed an astropath. If I was going to contact anyone, it would be off-world. I had no choice. I really couldn't trust anybody on the planet. The flyer was still parked in the back courtyard. Fabes had been good enough to run a power cable from the house, and the craft's batteries were recharging. It was hot in the yard. Insects buzzed in the thick spill of flowering bucanthus that covered the side wall. The mercenary was awake. He twisted his head from side to side as he heard me approach, blind and dumb. I tore the tape from his mouth and then filled a dish cup with water from a bottle I had borrowed from the kitchen. I held it up to his mouth. "It's just water. Drink it." He pursed his lips and turned his head away. "You'll dehydrate in this heat. Drink." He refused again. "Look, if you dehydrate, you'll become weak and far more vulnerable to my questions and mind probes." He paused and swallowed, but then shied away from the cup again as I brought it up. "Have it your way," I said, and put the dish down. The Vessarine were famously hardy. It was said they could go without food or water for days when battle demanded it. If he wanted to show off, it was fine by me. I rose and went over the body of the speeder carefully. I had borrowed a scanner wand from Crezia's study and set it to detect high and low band signals. Transponders, beacons, codes. I found nothing. For good measure, I swept the Vessarine too. Both flyer and prisoner were clean. If the mercenaries were looking for us, they wouldn't find us because of the craft or pilot. It had taken me half an hour to sweep the vessel. I went back to the pilot. The mid-morning sun was now high enough to throw sunlight in through the flyer's side hatch, and he was obviously feeling the heat because he'd drawn his legs up into what shade remained. I offered the water again. No response. "Tell me your name," I said. His jaw clenched. "Tell me your name," I repeated, using the will now. He shuddered.
"I know Goran."
His voice was dry and slurry. "And before it was I know Goran, your name was what?" His resolve was strong.
The Vessarine were a blunt race, with a high frequency of untouchables. Part of their martial training was to learn methods of resisting interrogation, and at first I thought he might have some well-developed mind trick to wall out psychic impulsions. But as I questioned him further, I began to suspect it was more to do with the emplated identity he was wearing. I tried to pick it away, but it still wouldn't budge. Crude and simple it may have been, but it was psychically riveted into place. Part of that profound fixture, I was sure, was acting as a screen. It wasn't that he wouldn't answer. He couldn't.
Gregor.
I looked out of the hatch and saw that Crezier had come out into the yard.
Gregor, what the hell are you doing?
I got out of the flyer and drew her back towards the garden doors. The Vessarine had undoubtedly heard her use my name. It couldn't be helped.
That man's tied up like a damned cygnet, she said.
That man would kill me, given the chance. He's tied up for all our sakes. I have to ask him questions. She glared at me. She had changed into a long gown of blue satin with an epingear trim. Her straw-blonde hair was tightly braided behind her head and held up by two golden pins. She was beautiful and haughty, just as I remembered her. Crezier had high cheekbones, a generous mouth, and pale brown eyes given to expressions of passion and intelligence. The only passion I had seen in them since my arrival had been fury.
Like a cygnet, she repeated. I won't have it. Not in my house.
Then what do you suggest? Have you a secure room? One that can be locked from outside?
Provide you with a cell for him? Pah!
She scoffed. It's that or the flyer. She thought about it.
I have Fabes clear out a box room upstairs.
No windows.
They all have damn windows. But the room I'm thinking of has just a small vein light, not big enough for anyone to get through.
Thank you.
I want to check him over.
There was no good arguing. She inspected the man carefully.
Don't be alarmed. I'm Dr.
He really doesn't need to know your name. Or mine. Think about it. She drew a deep breath.
I am a doctor. I'm only going to check on your health. Do you have a name?
He shook his head. He's using the name Ino Goran.
I see. Ino. This situation is unpleasant, but if you cooperate with me and with my associate here, it will work out for the best. Soon.
Associate. I could feel the spiteful relish he put into that word. Crezier looked at me disapprovingly.
He needs to drink and eat. Drink particularly in this heat.
Tell him, not me.
You need to drink, I know. If you don't drink, I'll have to put you on a fluid drip.
He allowed her to feed him the dish, and sipped slowly.
Very good, she said.
Then to me,
his bonds are far too tight.
That's not going to change.
Then get him up and walk him round a little. Tie his hands the other way.
Later, perhaps. If you knew what he was, what he has done, you wouldn't be so humane.
I'm an officer of the Medica Imperialis. It never matters what they've done.
We went back into the drawing room. His identity is emplated. I need to get past the barriers.
To find out who he really is?
To find out who he's working for.
I see.
She sat down, a bit at a fingernail. She always did that when she was troubled. You have medical stocks here. Zendocaine, Vulgate oxybarbital.
You're joking.
I shook my head and sat down opposite her, deadly serious. I need a psychoactive, or at least an opiate or barbiturate, to loosen his willpower.
No, absolutely no way. Crezier, I will not be a party to torture.
It is not torture. I'm not going to hurt him. I just need to open his mind.
No.
Crezier, I am going to do it. I have the mandate of the Holy Inquisition to perform interrogation, and these circumstances permit me an even greater latitude of emergency powers. Wouldn't you rather it be done under your expert supervision? In the latter part of the afternoon, we brought the Vessarine inside and put him in the box room Fabes had cleared. There was nothing in the room but a bed frame and mattress. I removed his blindfold and then covered him with the auto pistol as Amos removed his bindings. Crezier looked on, pointedly saying nothing about the weapon. "Unfasten your tunic again," I said. Crezier started to say something, but I cut her off. "You'll need to get at his arm, won't you, Doctor?"
There was another reason for getting him to disrobe. Amos carefully studied the man's tattoos, making notes. The Vessarine just stood there, stripped to the waist, sullen. He refused to make eye contact. I noticed he was slender but whipcord tough. The marks of old scars dotted his torso. I'd taken him to be a reasonably young man, but either he was older than he looked, or his short life had been barbarically tough. Amos finished.
I'll get it translated properly, but it's what I thought it was.
He turned to go downstairs. I stopped him and passed him the pistol. Cover him, please. Amos waited while I retied the merc's hands. I tied them in front of his body now, and then lashed his ankles together and tied off the end of that cord to the bedstead. Sit down, I told him. He sat. I took the weapon back from Amos, tucked it into my belt, and sent him on his way. If you will, Doctor. She looked at me.
Just like that.
Don't you want to give him the chance to volunteer first? There was no point, but I wanted to keep Grezier on side. Tell me your name, I said.
Ano Goran.
Tell me your real name.
Ano Goran.
I shot a warning look at Grezier and used the will. I focused it in the Vessarine's direction so she would be spared, but it still made her shiver. He gurgled a non-verbal response. Now, please. Grezier quickly injected 20 milliliters of Zendocaine into the man's upper arm and drew back. Zendocaine is a psychoactive, a synaptic enhancer that causes a flurry of cortex activity disguised by a soothing opiate. The man coughed, and after a few moments his eyes took on a glassy sheen. Grezier checked his blood pressure.
Fine, she said.
I placed my hand on the man's temple and eased my mind into his. He was relaxed and offered no resistance, but his mind was lively. An ideal balance if I was going to prize off his M-plated identity. I tried a few test questions, both verbally and mentally. His answers were slurred. What is your name?
Ano Goran.
What is your age?
40 standard.
What is your height?
2 1/3 quen.
That was a good sign. I had no idea what a quen was, but I'd take a bet it was a Vessarine measure. Where are we? I continued.
In the room.
Where is the room?
In a house. No.
On what world?
Gudrun.
What color is the sky?
This sky?
Yes. What color is this sky?
Blue.
What other sky might I have meant?
No.
What is my name?
Gregor.
How do you know that? I asked, without reacting.
She called you.
Grezier glanced at me nervously. Who does that make me?
Dunno.
Who might I be? Who do you suppose?
Eisenhorn.
Why do you know that name?
Job.
What job?
Me. Merkwerk. Pay job.
Tell me more about that.
Dunno more.
What is your name? I asked the mercenary again.
Told you. Ano Goran.
Where are you from?
Hesperus.
What color is the sky?
Blue. Definitely.
What is your name?
Ano Goran. Ano Goran. Ano Goran.
The words came out like a mountain stream, overlapping, light, without any meaning. Where are you from? I went on.
Hesperus, I don't know.
What does the tattoo on your upper body signify?
Bond.
In what language?
Don't know.
Is it a repatriation bond?
Uh-huh.
That's a mercenary custom, isn't it? It states, for any captor to see, that if you are returned to your homeworld, or an agency of your homeworld, unharmed, a bond will be paid. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Are you a mercenary?
Yes.
What color is the sky?
Blue. No. Yes, blue.
What is your name? I asked you, what is your name?
Wait. I know this. Be hard to think.
His eyes rolled in their sockets. What is your name?
Don't know.
Are you a mercenary?
Yeah.
Was I your target last night?
Yeah.
Who was your target last night?
Eisenhorn.
Am I Eisenhorn?
Yes.
He looked at me, but his eyes remained glassy, unfocused. What were your orders?
Chill them all. Burn the place.
Where did the orders come from?
Clansire Ettrick.
Is Clansire a rank?
Yeah.
Is Clansire Ettrick a Vessarin Janissary?
Yes.
Are you a Vessarin Janissary?
Yes.
What is your name, Janissary?
Sire. Vamiko Tal, sire.
He paused and blinked, not sure what he had just said. Crezier was staring at me. You're doing very well, Tal, I said.
Uh-huh.
The M-plate was shredding away from his mind like damp paper now. I went in for the kill with my full willpower now his mind was open. Where were you hired?
20 weeks ago. 20 weeks.
Where was that?
Heveron.
What were you doing there?
Looking for work.
Before that?
Be hired for a border war. Local governor hired us. But the war fizzled out.
And you found a new client?
The Clansire did. Good pay for a long-term hire. Off-world. Transit paid.
To do what?
They didn't tell us. Shipped us off to some place.
Where?
Gudrun.
Was it Gudrun?
Yeah.
A shudder went through him. And the job? In outline?
Hardware and flyers provided by client. Told to hit this place on the headland. Chill everyone.
Whose place was this?
Be someone called Eisenhorn.
How many men were hired?
All of us. The entire clan.
And how many men is that?
800.
I paused. 800? All for this job on Gudrun?
No, be 70 of us for that. The rest for other jobs.
What other jobs?
Wasn't told. Ah, my head aches.
Crezier touched my sleeve.
You must stop, she whispered. He's beginning to hyperventilate.
Just a few more questions, I hissed back. I looked at Tal. He was sweating and rocking slightly in his seat as his breaths came quick and fast. Where did you stage before the raid?
Pitero.
A small island in the Bay of Bishin. Interesting. What was the name of the ship that brought you here?
The Beltrand.
What was the name of your client?
Dunno.
Did you ever meet him?
No.
Did you ever meet any of his agents?
Yeah. It hurts.
Gregor.
Not yet. Tal, who was the agent?
Woman. Psyker. She came to emplate us the night before the raid.
She personally fixed your identity veils?
Yes.
What was her name?
Call herself Mala. Mala Tare.
Picture her in your mind, Tal, I ordered. I got a brief but vivid flash of a sharp-featured woman with long, straight black hair. Her eyes were what I remembered most. Coal-edged, large and green, like jade. She seemed to look into my head. I snatched back.
Are you all right?
Crezier asked.
Yes, I'm fine.
We're going to stop now,
she told me straight.
Right now.
Right now?
That's what I said.
The Janissary had sunk back on the bed, his skin puffy and damp. He closed his eyes and moaned.
He's coming down. Now he's feeling the disruptions of your mind probe.
I could see she was shaking slightly. She'd felt them too, second hand.
One last question.
I said we were stopping now and I meant it. I have to stabilize him.
I held out my hand. One more, while he's still open. We come back later or tomorrow and he'll have closed up. And you don't want to do this again, do you?
No,
she relented. Tal. Tal.
Go away.
What was the name of your client? What was the name of Marla Tare's boss? The Vessarin murmured something.
What was that? Whispered Crezier. I didn't catch it.
I had. Not verbally, but in my mind. Something blocked out. Something he hadn't been able to say before, even if he'd wanted to.
As he collapsed into Cy Fugue, the last shreds of his emplated veil melted away, and the final name tumbled out. He said, "Kanya," I told her. "Kanya the Sharp."